From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the Supreme Court heard arguments on DACA today. What's the case about, and what does it mean for thousands of Dreamers in Massachusetts?
I just hope that whoever's making these big decisions on the lives of so many people, they realize that we've been fighting.
Also today, rumblings of new Democratic presidential candidates, including Deval Patrick. Why? And is that a good idea?
In order to get into the race after the primaries, you have to be unique and you have to have depth in the party. And there doesn't seem to be anybody out there that could do that.
And a look ahead to tomorrow, the first day of public testimony in the House's impeachment inquiry.
What's important is for people to watch this with an open mind, and that's pretty much the impossible dream.
Next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We begin in Washington, where the Supreme Court heard opening arguments this morning in the case concerning the legality of the DACA program, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. The case consolidates three separate legal challenges to the Trump administration's attempt to end the Obama-era program, which delayed the deportation of hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children. WBUR senior correspondent Kimberly Atkins was in the court today. She joins us now from D.C. Kimberly, welcome.
Hi, Tiziana.
Hi there. So, Kimberly, what was the mood this morning as the court prepared to hear the arguments?
Yeah, so outside the court, there were hundreds of people, mostly people in favor of DACA, participants themselves, immigrants, and others, rallying outside the court. That's not unusual. You generally see people protesting one side and the other in a case. But what was unusual is that the crowd was very pro-DACA, and it was so big they actually had to close off the street right in front of the court, the street, First Street, that separates the court from the Congress. They had to close it down because there were so many people. Of course, inside the court, it was very staid and formal as the lawyers made their arguments in favor and against keeping that program in place.
So a really important case, clearly. It's three combined. What was at the heart of what was before the court today?
So essentially, there are challengers, which include 16 states, including Massachusetts, and other groups who said the decision by Donald Trump, the Trump administration, to end this program was made contrary to federal law. Now, remember, DACA was implemented in 2012 by Barack Obama when Congress failed to come up with any sort of immigration solution to deal with immigrants at all, particularly these young dreamers, people who were brought into the country as children who really don't know any other place and who just want to work and go to school or enroll into the military. So he created this program to allow them a legal path to do that, not citizenship, but just be able to legally work and go to school and join the military in the country. President Trump came in and initially said he was going to leave it in place. But as the political tides turned and he wanted to campaign on being tough on immigration, instead decided to rescind it. And that put the fate of between 700,000 and 800,000 people enrolled in this program in jeopardy.
So was this a situation where one side said it wasn't legal in the first place and the other side said, well, you can't just end it?
Yes. So essentially, what the challengers were saying is that the way that the Trump administration ended it violated a law called the Administrative Procedure Act. If it sounds dry, that's because it is.
And it does.
But what it basically means is an agency can't just make a decision. It has a lot of broad authority, but it can't just make a decision for an arbitrary and capricious reason. They have to put forward a real justifiable reason to do that. And these challengers said the Trump administration has not done that. The administration shoots back and says, well, we'd have put forward a reason. We believe that DACA was illegal and that we had to do it. But even if the court finds that it wasn't illegal, we still have the authority to do it. And so that's where the push and pull really is on the merits of this case.
So you were in the room. How did the court seem to be receiving the arguments? Was there any telegraphing there of how this might come out?
Not much. I mean, sometimes you see it. It's always a tricky proposition to try to guess what the court will do based on arguments. But more or less, it seemed pretty ideologically split, with the more conservative justices seeming to be sympathetic to the administration's arguments and the more liberal justices siding with the challengers. It probably will come down to Chief Justice Roberts. But there is a potential twist. There is one argument in this case that says, look, the government can put forward a reason, but if it's a bad reason or if it's not the real reason, then that can't stand. Something very similar happened in the census case, if you recall, that the reason that the government gave for trying to put the citizenship question on the 2020 census, the court found that while the government really could do it for any reason, the reason that they gave was bad. And that was one of the arguments made by the challengers. And John Roberts joined in finding in the census case in ruling that the reason that the Trump administration gave was bad. So I would watch him in this case, but that's one potential way that these challengers could possibly win.
So since the administration announced it would end DACA in 2017, a bunch of lower courts have been kind of instrumental in shielding the Dreamers from deportation through various stays. How will those lower court decisions be factored into the court case now that it's before the Supreme Court?
Yeah. So, I mean, one reason is that when you have a program like this with so many participants, hundreds of thousands, as I mentioned, upwards of 8,000 in Massachusetts alone, the idea that the court could rule that it could go away and suddenly upend not only the lives of these people, but on the employers that rely on them and the schools and universities where they're enrolled, could create a lot of problem. And that was one reason why the lower courts kept this in place while these challenges worked their way up. There are a lot of things the court can do, even if they rule that the Trump administration can eliminate the program. They can do it in a phased way or send it down so and order the Department of Homeland Security to establish some sort of way to do it so that it's not the least it's the least impact on these people. But at the end of the day, that would mean that these people would be eligible for deportation. Again, a reminder that there are more than 11 million people by conservative estimates in the country without proper documentation. And so the idea that they will all suddenly be deported is just not logistically possible. Generally speaking, there is a priority system that focuses on people who, you know, commit felonies or people who are suspected of terrorism. So they probably won't be deported, but they won't have that ability to work legally, to go to school or to enter the military.
Kimberly, when do you think the court is going to make its decision on this, and what happens between now and that time?
Well, that's also an interesting thing. Big cases like this tend to be among the last cases that the court decides, because usually there's a lot of arguments and dissents being written and the court really wrangles with it. So it could come out as late as June when the court's term ends. Of course, that would be right in the middle of the general election season, when you'll have Donald Trump going against the Democratic nominee and immigration promises to be a huge issue. So this could just throw fuel on the fire of that right in the middle of a very political time.
That's a very interesting timing. That is WBUR's senior correspondent Kimberly Atkins. Kimberly, thanks for giving us some time.
My pleasure.
So here in Massachusetts, there are more than 5,600 DACA recipients monitoring this case closely. Some of them joined local advocates and political leaders at Cambridge City Hall today to speak out against the Trump administration's efforts to end the program. WBUR Shannon Dooling was there, and she joins us now in Studio 3. Shannon, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us what you saw and heard at today's event.
Right. Well, we heard from a few elected officials and local DACA recipients. And, you know, I have to say that after covering the developments around DACA for a few years now, this press conference had this sort of deja vu element to it, where we've been hearing these same arguments in favor of DACA. We've been hearing stories from DACA recipients for 2 years now, ever since the Trump administration tried to rescind the program in 2017. And it's really impactful to think about all of these young people and the very real limbo they've been living in all this time. And I got the sense that having the question before the Supreme Court, this question of whether the Trump administration was within its powers by ending the program the way it did, that at least offers this opportunity for some sort of resolution, one way or another. It just feels like almost a culmination of sorts.
Shannon, what is the makeup of Dreamers here in the Commonwealth? Where are they from? Where are they living in the state?
Right. So we know that there are approximately 17,000 people who are eligible for DACA here in Massachusetts. But as of now, there are more than 5,600 active DACA recipients in the state. Interestingly, that number was more than 6,000 active DACA recipients in 2018. But since then, it's dropped a little bit. And that could be because people have chosen not to enroll with the news of the Trump administration trying to rescind the program. Maybe they think that they can't enroll. The application is also almost $500. You have to reapply every 2 years. And people may have possibly even dropped out of the program fearing that if it does indeed end, then they'll automatically be vulnerable for deportation. The majority of recipients do live in the greater Boston area. We know nationally the overwhelming majority of recipients are from Mexico, but here in Massachusetts, most of the people eligible for DACA are actually from Guatemala, Brazil, and El Salvador.
You heard us talk with Kimberly about the possible outcomes. What's at risk for DACA recipients?
I mean, the short answer is a lot. Beyond even just, you know, the ultimate threat of deportation. DACA allows these folks to get a driver's license. They can apply for Social Security number. They can apply for in-state tuition in Massachusetts, work permits. And of course, I mean, just the overall peace of mind that comes with having a status, even if it is temporary.
And at the same time, what would Massachusetts lose if the court ultimately decides that DACA is unconstitutional, especially what would we lose economically?
Yeah, the fiscal price tag is pretty steep. I mean, you take into account the presence of DACA recipients in all sorts of sectors, students, teachers, doctors, business owners, homeowners, and they're taxpayers. And an analysis from the libertarian think tank, the Cato Institute, estimated Massachusetts's economy could stand to lose upwards of $924 million over 10 years if DACA were to disappear.
So this event today in Cambridge, Congresswoman Catherine Clark was there. Mm-hmm. What does she have to say?
Right. Well, of course, she represents Cambridge. She's calling on the Senate to take up the Dream and Promise Act, which she co-sponsored and which passed the House earlier this year. Many of the Massachusetts delegation, members of the Massachusetts delegation co-sponsored that. That legislation would offer a pathway to citizenship for DACA and for temporary protected status recipients, TPS. We've heard a lot about that lately. And that's not currently an option that exists with either of those temporary statuses. Let's take a listen to Clark.
This is really giving a future for those young Americans who are already meeting with great academic success, serving in our military, who are parents of American children. This is what's at stake for our country. It is the fair and right and very American thing to do.
The Dream and Promise Act passed the House back in June, but since then it's just been stalled in the Senate.
There were some Dreamers who found their voices and really spoke out publicly today, too, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, the people who have chosen to speak out about their status and in favor of DACA, they are doing so knowing full well that they could be at risk of deportation at some point. And it's a risk they're willing to take. But, you know, a sentiment I've been hearing more of lately from DACA recipients, again, as this turmoil has sort of gone on for a few years now, here in Massachusetts, among many of them, there's this feeling of sort of being singled out as almost this sort of good, quote-unquote, good immigrant, right? They're somehow more deserving than others who don't qualify for DACA. Carlos Aguilar is a graduate student at Harvard. He's getting his PhD there, and he's also a Dreamer who came to the U.S. from Mexico when he was 14. He said, you know, sure, he's a success story, but he made a point to also say he's a reflection of his parents' hard work and sacrifices.
I am scared. I am tired of living like this. I know that many of us don't want to continue doing this and really want a protection not only for us but for our families.
So you can hear him there. There is really this feeling among many Dreamers that they'd like to see protections extended not just for themselves but for many undocumented immigrants overall.
What did Cambridge city officials have to say? I mean, the city's long referred to itself as a sanctuary city.
Yeah, I think it takes a lot of pride in the fact that it is one of the state's first, quote unquote, you know, so-called sanctuary cities, which isn't a legal definition, but really means there are pro-immigrant policies in place. The mayor there, Mayor Mark McGovern, pointed out that a third of the city's residents are foreign-born, and they don't have an exact figure of how many DACA recipients live in Cambridge, but they know many of them are working and living in Cambridge.
Are you hearing concern about the possible outcome of the case now that it's before the court?
Yeah, I mean, of course. It's been years of turmoil at this point. It means college students don't know if they'll be eligible for in-state tuition. Parents with U.S. citizen children are having to think about hypothetical plans if they lose their DACA status. Homeowners are thinking about mortgage payments. It's a lot to consider.
So, Shannon, stay with us for a minute.
Sure.
To learn more about how this is resonating with the state's DACA recipients, we wanted to hear from one of them. Her name is Stephanie Pineda. We spoke with her this afternoon between her classes at UMass Boston, where she's a junior. She says that she and other Dreamers are hopeful but nervous.
Right now, I'm just glad that this is getting to the Supreme Court. I'm glad there is a hearing today. But I feel like sometimes if it's not something like this, we're not talking about it. No senators, no congresspeople are talking about it. And I feel like this has to be pushed more every day, not just when there's a hearing. So I feel like in that sense, sometimes we do take a few steps backwards. People want the decision to be made, but there's not a lot that goes into it before, again, one of the major things comes up.
You are a junior, and you have said a couple of times that you'd like to go to grad school. Junior year is a time when young people really start thinking of what comes next. How do you think about that for yourself in this moment of uncertainty?
About a week ago, I had my appointment with my advisor, and I was speaking to her on how my mind can't wrap around the fact that I'm almost done, and talking also about grad school plans. And I'm like, I know my permit expires next year, and it's like I still won't be done with my bachelor's degree. And if I'm able to reapply, depending on what happens, should I even be thinking about graduate school when I don't even know what's going to happen during my senior year of my undergrad?
Stephanie, last summer when we talked, you reflected on your decision last time to receive DACA status. You expressed some concern that you were sort of calling attention to yourself. You were saying, hey, I'm here. But ultimately, you decided to do it. It doesn't sound like you feel that way now. If the option to reapply comes up, it sounds like you would really want to do that. Is that true?
I feel like, yes, I'm still scared. That feeling is still there. But I feel like me not applying or not giving it another shot, whatever happens, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, I feel like at this point, I just want to do everything that's in my hands to be able to attain the goals and attain, I guess, as we're called dreamers, the dreams that I have for myself being in this country.
Stephanie, I know this is a really hard question, but there is a possibility that next summer the Supreme Court will find that the president has the authority to end DACA. If that happens, do you have any idea what you'll do?
I unfortunately haven't gotten there yet. I've been trying to maintain a positive attitude, but it's always trying to find a way where there seems to be no way. So I think if that decision were to be made, it's just being able to at least finish my undergrad and then see what happens from there, what personally a decision has made on my life, and as well as in general for all DACA recipients.
Stephanie, you expressed some hope. What gives you hope?
I actually read something today that the president put out saying that all dreamers are not angels, that there are criminals. And again, just for whoever's hearing this, those of us who have received DACA and who continue to be able to reapply, we're still going through background checks. If there's something there that they don't like, then we won't receive that permit. So I just wanted to make that clear. But I think the hope goes into that aspect that we're a lot of the dreamers are professionals. A lot of the dreamers are lawyers, teachers. And it's like, I just hope that whoever's making these big decisions on the lives of so many people, they realize that we've been fighting, that we're not doing anything wrong, that we're working, that we're professionals, that we're helping kids, that we're helping a variety of people, that we do give back to this country, so that they focus on the positives that we give to this country, which I think the positives are larger than the negatives.
That was Estefany Pineda, who is a Massachusetts resident, a UMass student, and currently enrolled in DACA. And I want to turn back to WBUR's Shannon Dooling. Shannon, thanks for staying with us there. I know you know Estefany. What's your reaction to what we just heard from her? And what do you think she should be expecting and thinking about as we move toward this Supreme Court decision?
Yeah, it's interesting to hear her think back on this. I actually met Estefany on her first day of classes at UMass Boston, which happened to be the same day that Jeff Sessions announced the end of the DACA program. So here is this young woman who is in between classes, taking time out of her first day of university classes ever to sit and talk with a reporter about what she's thinking and feeling. And at that point, 2 years ago, she asked that she only be identified by her middle name because she was nervous to be on the record talking about this for fear of, you know, retribution. And it's remarkable, I think, to me to hear her really stand up and use not only her first name, but to say, I'm going to reapply and I'm going to find a way where there's no way. And so I think I'm struck by her evolution, but also I think by the fact that she's still trying to figure out a way to finish college. You know, that first day of college, she said, I'm just going to try to get through this day and then I'll try to get through the next day. And here we are 2 years later and she's still really just trying to focus on one goal at a time.
Thanks for that. That's WBUR immigration reporter Shannon Dooling. I appreciate you joining us.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. Coming up, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick is considering jumping into the 2020 primary. Should he? We'll take your calls. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Let's talk about two big names who've been rethinking their decisions about 2020, starting with former Governor Deval Patrick. He told WBUR last December why he and his wife had decided that he would not run for president in 2020.
As Diane and I reflected on it, we realized that there's no way around the fact that the process is cruel.
So now there are multiple reports that Governor Patrick is taking another look at jumping into the Democratic presidential primary race. Also thinking about a run, former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg. He's already filed paperwork for the Alabama primary, and he's in Arkansas doing the same thing today. So what's going on? Why are people like Bloomberg and Patrick thinking about running now? And is it too late to do so? With us to break it all down is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, welcome.
Hi.
Also from Washington, we're joined by Elaine Kmark. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a superdelegate to the Democratic Convention, and she served in the White House from 1993 to 1997 and was a senior policy advisor to the Al Gore campaign in 2000. Elaine, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Also here in Studio 3 is Michael Curry, former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors. Michael, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
And of course, there's you. Pull up a chair. Do you think Patrick or Bloomberg should enter the race at this point, or are you satisfied with the current slate of Democratic candidates? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Anthony, I'm going to start with a couple of questions to you.
Sure.
First, what do we know so far about why Patrick may be mulling jumping in? What changed?
Yeah, right. Well, here's what we know, which was first reported last night by the New York Times. So we know that Governor Patrick called Joe Biden last week to tell him that he was considering a run, and that Patrick told party leaders that he doesn't think any of the Democratic presidential candidates have established real political momentum. And now, as we know, the race right now is focused on Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, and Bernie Sanders, who lead most national polling and in the early voting states. Pete Buttigieg is also making a strong case in Iowa and New Hampshire. But none of them is running away with the race yet. And so Patrick thinks there's an opening for someone like him, someone who can unite liberals and moderate Democrats. And he's going to have to make up his mind pretty quickly because the filing deadline in New Hampshire is this coming Friday.
As you're reporting this, what are you hearing from Patrick's people, his allies? So,
yeah, well, it's fascinating because Patrick has this core group of folks who are ready to drop everything and support a possible presidential bid a year ago. But as we know, as you mentioned, Tiziana, Patrick decided not to do that. So these folks all went in different directions and got busy with other projects supporting other candidates. And one of them suggested to me that they were all pretty surprised and are now watching from the sidelines with a good deal of surprise. But there's a sense that Patrick is doing this because of concerns that Joe Biden isn't as strong as he needs to be. His fundraising has been lagging. He hasn't appeared sharp in the debates. And a number of people from, we understand, from former President Obama's team have been urging Patrick to do this. So here we are.
Do you think his allies like his chances?
Well, you know, I think, look, it's a long shot. I think everybody understands that. What Patrick is a compelling figure. He's a stirring orator. He's well known in New Hampshire. He's got relationships with a number of folks who worked with President Obama. So if he could get the whole Obama operation back up and running like tomorrow, maybe this could go somewhere. On the other hand, it's a huge challenge to build a campaign from scratch this late in the date, this late in the process. I mean, he's not like Michael Bloomberg, a billionaire who can self-fund his campaign. So he'd be at a big disadvantage there. So there's some big challenges. That said, his supporters say, look, this is a compelling candidate. If anybody could do a sort of come from behind campaign, he's the guy who could do it. But it's a long shot.
I want to turn to Elaine Kmark now. Elaine, does the entry or possible entry of such last-minute candidates signal to you that we have a weak field in America on the Democratic side?
I think it signals that people are worried about the field. On the other hand, at this stage of the game, what's happening is that all the candidates who've announced have been out there for a while now, and people realize, oh, they have feet of clay, as the saying goes. Everybody knows the downsides to Joe Biden. They know the downsides to Elizabeth Warren, et cetera, et cetera. So what generally happens at this point is that people start looking for somebody who's perfect, a knight on a white horse who's going to come in and just save the party and defeat Trump. Well, the fact of the matter is there is nobody who's perfect. I think that both these candidates, I think Deval Patrick was a fabulous governor of Massachusetts. I think that Mike Bloomberg was a great mayor of New York. I've actually lived in both places and can attest to their skills at governance. But neither of them know the country, the nation, like a president and like a presidential candidate gets to know the nation. So they're a little bit late to the game.
So I'll turn to Michael Curry then. Michael, I really like Elaine's, you know, they're discovering feet of clay. Get 24 pairs of feet, right, that entered this race at the beginning. Yes, feet of clay, but really no one who's sort of the exciting focal point at this point for the race?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd characterize it that way. I think it's a strong field. I think there are some exciting candidates in the field. I travel this country quite a bit, and folks are excited about each of them. I have some strong Biden supporters, some strong Senator Warren supporters who asked me questions about how she governed here in Massachusetts. So I think it's a strong feel. I think that Deval and Bloomberg entering the race is because they feel there's something missing. Either they don't feel, which actually goes against the polls, that any of the existing candidates have a strong chance of beating Donald Trump, or they just feel like there's a message missing, or they don't want to go as far as maybe Senator Warren does on some of her policy issues, or they don't think Biden has the longevity to really last this whole campaign. Whatever that is, I can speak in particular about Governor Patrick in that I know him, spent some time traveling the country with him and meeting with folks on the ground. He actually has a strong presence across the country. I was just talking just a few minutes ago that I got 30 text messages overnight from 21 to 35-year-olds across the country, no exaggeration, who said I would quit my job today and come work for him. He has that kind of appeal that I think people across the country would say, hey, I want to work for him. I'd be excited. Bloomberg, he's a multi-billionaire. He's, I think, $52-plus billion net worth. That's a lot of money, and you can really influence a campaign with money. I don't know what will result from their entering the campaign, but I think it makes for an even stronger field.
I'm going to take a couple of calls. First, Tori from Westford, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to weigh in on, it sounded like Deval Patrick's, one of his reasoning for getting in was that he didn't see the candidates as having momentum and having a lot of enthusiasm around them, and I just disagree, because if you look at Bernie Sanders and the numbers he's drawing of 25,000 people at his rallies, and even Elizabeth Warren has some momentum behind her as well, I think he should just call a spade a spade. It sounds like he's saying you know, there's not enough momentum around the establishment or more moderate candidates. I think that would be more accurate to say, because Americans are excited about progressive ideas right now.
Okay.
70% of Americans want Medicare for all. So I think.
Thanks, Tori. Thanks. So I want to add one more call. Linda from Quincy. Linda, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to give my.
Oops, Linda, we lost running. You. Oh, there she is.
Oh, hi.
Try again.
So I wanted to give. Oh, okay. So I just wanted to give my input about Governor Patrick running and saying that he could excite the party with his candidacy. And I don't see that. I don't see the difference between him and the other candidates that are running. And actually, someone who would really excite the party would be Michelle Obama. And she would get my vote if she decided to run.
Okay. So. Thanks, Linda. So there are three things that I want to get at in those two calls. I'm going to kind of go in reverse order, starting with you, Elaine. Does it take a Michelle Obama to come in at this point and have traction this late in a race?
It probably does. And the reason is that what she has or somebody like her has that the other people don't is they have a real national base and real national experience. 30 people volunteering to go to work for a candidate is about what you need for one county in Iowa. So it's, you know, people always underestimate the amount and the depth of knowledge and experience and contacts that you need in 50 states in order to win a presidential nomination. So somebody like Michelle Obama could maybe pull that off because she does have a national base because of her husband, but there's not very many people out there who could.
All right. And Anthony, what about this point that actually there are some candidates with very strong momentum? Is this the establishment being worried or are there really are we really experiencing a dearth of excitement around the existing candidate base?
Well, to the last question, no, I don't think we're experiencing a dearth of excitement. I mean, I'm sort of amused by this whole thing because it wasn't long ago that there were 27 candidates and people were saying, oh, my God, we've got to winnow this field. And now it's down to, what, 23? And suddenly we're saying we don't have enough candidates. So I'm sort of amused by that. But no, look, when I'm out on the campaign trail, we heard the caller. She's absolutely right. Bernie Sanders is drawing huge crowds, lots of excitement at Warren's campaigns. Pete Buttigieg is coming up and drawing, I think he had something like 1,300 people up in, I'm forgetting where, last week in New Hampshire. I mean, there's a lot of excitement around these people. And I think, and look, a number of polls tell us again and again that Democratic voters are really pretty happy with this selection of candidates. So I think you can raise the question and ask Deval Patrick, really, you're going to come in this late? And what about all those people who have already been out there for so long? You know, I spoke to one presidential Democratic campaign manager last night who said, we've genuinely built something. Is all that going to disappear in a moment just because Deval Patrick gets in the race at this late date? So I think it's a fair question.
Go ahead, Michael.
It's interesting. I think Deval's consideration and even Bloomberg's consideration is really about it's a fragmented race right now because so many people are in different camps. Mm-hmm. You know, when I think about Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, who I've talked to and got a chance to sit with when he was here recently, you think about Senator Warren, who I think is a dynamic candidate, but they don't have much traction in African-American communities, right? If you look around southern states with large numbers of African-Americans, they haven't gained traction. What does that mean? I think that's probably part of the consideration for a candidate like Deval Patrick is I can bring that communities of color base to the election behind me. I can actually pull the moderates, the liberals to the table behind his candidacy. So I think he's considering it in terms of bringing all those different factions within the Democratic Party together. I think that's a legitimate consideration.
Elaine, that does raise a question. I mean, at one point, 27, right? Then 24.
Right.
We still have a lot of candidates. Still worried about fitting them all on the stage at a debate. Is there any part of the Democratic Party continuum that, in fact, is missing or not represented already among the landscape of current candidates?
No, I'd say we've got them all, okay? I think we've got the full diversity of the Democratic Party is on that stage, has been on that stage. We even already have a billionaire. We even have Tom Steyer on the stage. So we'd have two billionaires. We'd have several people of color. We have a lot of women. The party in its diversity has been well represented already, and I don't think they really particularly need the addition of more people. But let's go to the question of the African-American base, which is critical to the Democratic Party. What happened in 2008 was that Barack Obama proved that he could win votes in a very white state, Iowa. And until he proved that, the African-American base was with Hillary Clinton. And then within a couple of weeks, by the time the candidates got to South Carolina, that race had changed and Barack Obama had a solid base in the African-American community. So the same thing would have to happen this time. Someone like Deval Patrick or Cory Booker or Kamala Harris, if they can win Iowa, they're going to really, you know, sweep through a lot of those southern primaries. But right now, Joe Biden is holding on to the African-American base. That is a source of his strength. And you will need someone to defeat Biden in one of those early primaries to start cutting into that base.
Michael, you're nodding a lot as Elena's speaking.
Yeah, I think she's absolutely correct. I think, you know, when President Obama won in Des Moines, it said to all those African-Americans that we have a viable candidate. We have someone who could actually win this race. And though they liked Hillary Clinton, though they were longtime Clinton supporters, they decided to put their support and their eventual vote behind the candidate they most wanted. I think Biden runs a little bit of that risk here, too. African-Americans support Biden because they want to get rid of Trump and they see him as the most viable candidate to do that. But at the time that they see potentially Kamala, potentially even Senator Warren or Cory Booker as a viable candidate, I think there'll be a dramatic shift in votes.
Anthony, so as I'm listening to Elaine and Michael, it's making me want to ask you, you've been covering presidential races for a while. There are little bits of this that feel reflective of the Republican side in 2016. Huge landscape, wide range of candidates. The establishment gets very nervous because there's a kind of an extreme candidate who's gaining in popularity. Do you see parallels here with what happened for the Republican Party in 2016?
That's interesting. I hadn't really thought of that. You know, I'm really just sort of struck by this idea that there are so many candidates and here we are at this late date adding more candidates. But, you know, I think you raise an interesting point. I think there are some parallels there to be sure.
And Elaine, how about you?
Well, I think it's a little bit different. And the reason it's different is that the Republican Party has a set of rules state by state that are winner-take-all rules. And what that meant in 2016 for the Republicans was that Donald Trump could accumulate a delegate lead that was fairly substantial fairly early on, even though his votes were not all that substantial. In other words, he was winning, but he was winning very narrowly. In the Democratic Party, it's kind of the opposite. In the Democratic Party, we apportion delegates proportionally by congressional district. What that means is that it's very hard for somebody to emerge, and we might have, in fact, a splintered field if there is no clear-cut winner. And the winners have a hard time winning, whereas in the Republican side, if you win by a small amount, you can really take off.
All right.
And that's what happened to Trump.
Elaine Kmark, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, thank you. WBUR Senior Political Reporter Anthony Brooks, thanks.
Hey, my pleasure.
And Michael Curry, former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and on the national board, thank you.
Always glad to be here.
Stay tuned. There's more ahead. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Public testimony in the House's impeachment inquiry is set to begin tomorrow. People across the country will be able to tune in one way or another. More than 40 years ago, when Congress held public Watergate hearings to look into an alleged cover-up by the Nixon administration, it wasn't as easy to follow along real time. Most folks got their news from nightly newscasts, and here's a little taste of what that sounded like.
Washington has been inundated by another massive set of Watergate transcripts. The stack of documents was distributed by the House Judiciary Committee yesterday to the news media for dissemination this evening.
Evidence in tonight's document shows the president was apprehensive about possible Watergate disclosures less than 2 weeks after the break-in on the Democratic Party headquarters.
Now at last, under oath and in public, James McCord, the one-time security director for the committee to re-elect the president, fleshed out the charges alluded to in his letter to the judge.
That was Roger Mudd, Leslie Stahl, and Sam Donaldson. So with a totally transformed media landscape today, what does that mean for this week's proceedings? How will the public consume the proceedings? How will they resonate with the public today? For more, we turn to Toby Berkowitz. He's a professor of advertising at Boston University and has consulted on political campaigns across the country. Toby, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
All right, so I want to start, Toby, with a look back. You heard a little taste there of the coverage of the Watergate hearings. I was really struck by the line from Roger Mudd at the opening where he said, quote, "This stack of documents was distributed by the House committee yesterday to the news media for dissemination this evening." Clearly, there was a middleman and everyone accepted it. How did the way the news was delivered and consumed affect the country's attitude toward those hearings at that time?
Well, people were watching television and they'd be sitting in front of a television, sometimes with their family, and everyone was sort of glued to it. You didn't have a lot of alternatives for live coverage. You also didn't have the constant punditry that we have now. So it was a very different situation. It was also a different time because that was a major big scandal. We've had lots of scandals and lots of hearings since then.
How does that last part figure in? What is it about frankly, we've had so many scandals since then. Tell me more about that.
There've been all sorts of different scandals, and a lot of them have been sort of sexual in nature. The Watergate situation was totally different in that this was now corruption of government. Now, we're looking with Trump. Is that what it's going to be this time?
But versus Clinton, which is the sexual one, I think.
Exactly.
You're referring to.
There's a big difference between breaking into a national political headquarters and a dress. And so the situation is very different. People now are their own news editors. Everyone is picking, what do I want to read, watch, listen to when I want? That's very, very different. And that's what's going to make this so different from past hearings.
So in 1973, PBS re-aired the Watergate hearings. This is remarkable. In their entirety, in prime time, starting at 8 p.m., which was 51 nights that they did this. The network has said, nope, we're not going to do the same thing this time around for the impeachment inquiry hearing. This public portion. That decision actually led former PBS journalist Bill Moyers to take out a full-page ad in the New York Times saying, please change your plans. Please do it. Is that a loss that we're not going to have that kind of evening primetime airing?
It's not really a loss because anyone can watch the hearings in their entirety whenever they want.
Will
and that's
anyone?
The big, I don't know. Journalists certainly will.
I will.
Politicos will. The question really, and this is the most important part, will the civilians, will regular voters be captivated by this, or is it going to be, oh my gosh, please, can I just go back to my reality programming? Oh, wait a minute, we have a reality program president. So the whole landscape has changed so dramatically.
So Toby, how important, so I'm going to ask you a two-part question. First, how important is it for people to consume large chunks at a time of these hearings in order to be able to be truly informed about what's going on? And from a more normative or sort of ethical perspective, should it matter whether or not it's gripping to a citizen to sit down and take in large pieces of this?
Well, I'll answer your second question first. If it's not gripping, there are just too many alternatives and people will have other things that they can do. They can also get how they want the snippet, the punditry on their own, whenever they want. I'm sorry if you repeat your first question.
My first question was, in order to be able to participate as citizens, how important is it to consume large chunks at a time of these kinds of hearings?
I don't know if you need large chunks, but you need direct chunks without someone interpreting it for you. And that's going to be the toughest part of all of these hearings is, can anyone just watch, whether it's on their mobile or on their flat screen, without the constant punditry and analysis? And that's just not going to happen. More and more people will get how they perceive this from whoever their favorite pundit is, their favorite analyst, whether it's on talk radio, cable television, the radio, however they want to get it.
So how much does the pundit or the analyst affect what the person thinks about the content they're seeing? I get it if all you get is what the analyst says. You don't watch any of it yourself. But do we have any way of knowing if you have actually consumed the content yourself, how much does the analyst layer affect what you think or how you perceive it?
Probably not too much, because you're going to tune in to the pundit who you want, the analyst who you want. And that's the entire landscape. You can Two people can watch the exact same hearing, and then they're going to go to their own mobile, they're going to go to their own cable, they're going to go to their own streaming, and they're going to get two different versions of what just happened. It's sort of Rashomon played out for the public in politics. Not a very healthy way, I think, for democracy to work.
You know, the more I listen to you, I wasn't thinking about this earlier today, but the more I listen to you, I keep thinking of NFL Red Zone. Now, I don't know if you're an NFL fan. All right, so NFL Red Zone basically is a set of stations where you can tune into a game and only watch the part where somebody might score, basically. So you're not watching the whole game. You're not really understanding what's happening between the teams, et cetera. There are those who are like, awesome, I can only watch the parts that interest me. And others who say you're missing something fundamental about the game if you don't actually watch it. Do we miss something fundamental about the game here if we only watch the Red Zone segments?
Sure. What you're missing is the process. You're missing the depth. You're missing what someone else might think is important. And that's the problem. What you're going to see in the Red Zone is that sound bite, whether it's a congressperson jumping up and down or whoever is testifying. So it's a highlight reel, but you're not seeing, if you want to use a bad metaphor again, you know, the football players who are blocking for the quarterback. You're just watching that touchdown.
I think we can both agree that my Red Zone was a bad metaphor. But
no, I don't know. No, not too bad.
So to use another one that is distasteful, but I think appropriate, let's talk about the theater of this, right? We've already heard or seen much of the testimony that we're going to see in the next few weeks in written form. A lot of it's come out. So presumably what's important next is how it's going to be delivered firsthand by the people who give it. And that's going to be done under even higher pressure. So how important is the performance in how people will perceive the import and the outcome?
Go back to Watergate, John Dean. It was the content, what he said, but it was also how he said it. So I think it's both of these things. But we also have to look at—
Now, I'm going to stop you there. Explain for people who are listening who didn't see how John Dean said it. How did he say it, and why was that important?
He spoke very directly with sort of a semi-baritone, which I don't do a very good impression of. But it was just very precise, very unemotional, and exceedingly detailed. And that was very different from what people were expecting. The one other part of performance that you have to look at are the people in the Congress, in the Senate. And that was a huge part of Watergate, the Sam Irvins, the Thompsons, the Sam Dashes. And then by the time we got to the House, the Peter Rodinos. Compare Rodino to Adam Schiff. It's a whole different world.
Why?
Because Rodino was much more straightforward. Of course, he's a politician. He's from New Jersey. But he saw himself as a congressperson first, and it was part of the House. Now it's all partisan. And so for everybody, the Republicans, the Democrats, the House, the Senate. And so Rodino sort of stepped away from the partisanship to some degree, as much as that was possible.
So I also want to talk about the relevance of these public hearings. A Gallup poll found that 71% of the American public watched the Watergate hearings live. And they had a real impact. People changed their minds or began to. And this was before the Supreme Court ordered Nixon to turn over his tapes, before the Saturday Night Massacre. According to Gallup, after the hearings, 53% of people viewed Watergate as a serious matter, up from 31%. Today, will any of this move anyone, or are people already locked in their camps?
I think people are absolutely locked in their camps. But a big surprise, a major development on either side could end up all of a sudden shifting maybe the 5 to 10 to 15% who might be persuadable one way or another. And that's really, as these hearings go on, that's what to look for. Not what the partisans are doing, because they're already baked in, but what about what might be considered sort of the swing voters, people whose minds might be made up and might change?
Toby, is there any way for the country to come through this process unified, or at least not less unified than the country is today, this minute?
No, that's very doubtful. These are exceedingly partisan hearings, which, by the way, is what impeachment is. Impeachment is a political process, and people have to understand that. It's just going to reinforce everything more and more and more, unless something happens that is so dramatic that just totally changes the game. But we've seen Trump manage to slip away time and time again from what people thought was going to change the game. And yet, like the Energizer Bunny, he just sort of keeps going on.
And last word, what should people be looking for these next couple of weeks, watching for?
What people should watch for is there a real revelation that both sides agree is, in fact, a fact? And what we've seen all along is what seems to be a fact. Each side says, no, that's not a fact. It's a fake fact. Is there anything that people will agree on that's going to be seen in these hearings?
Well, on that note, that's Toby Berkowitz, Boston University advertising professor and political media consultant. Toby, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. We are Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.